This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So I have to ask you, one of the most amazing things about the film is there seems like there's so many details with all the little elves. How many different versions of elves did you guys create?
Well, the theory, I mean, we have a complete, like, numbers plan. Pete and I worked out when we were writing it exactly how many elves it would take. So there are supposed to be 1 million field elves in 330,000 individual teams. There are three different types in each team. So we have an entire kind of ranking, order system, etc. for elves. And then back in the mission control, there are 10,000 workstations for elves. And, of course, you know, there are a number of hero elves, and then the rest were generated by character variation systems. So, you know, they designed different, I think about 15 different skin tones, about 20 different hairstyles for male and female, and different body types, head shapes, and so on. And then, effectively, they go through the massive program, which generates vast numbers, and then I went along going, that doesn't look like an elf, that does look like an elf. And so you just select your kind of heroes. But I did drive everyone completely insane with elves for ages because there's a lot of other details in the movie too. But, you know, we had a whole plan of who does what and how they work. And actually, a thing that no one in the world will ever see, but on their arms, they have badges according to what unit and area and division that they work in. And I was always going, wait a minute. When they were showing me shots with so many complex things, I was going, wrong colour hat. He shouldn't be wearing that shirt. And they were having to like resort the elves into different categories. But we kind of wanted to work it out in depth because I think if you're trying to put up a whole alternative world, you need to really know it yourself in depth so that even if you just get a glimpse of it for a kid, it feels coherent and you kind of go, yeah, that could be real. But in order to give that just brief impression, I think you have to work out the rules of your world in huge detail, which in my case went down to what badges were. They have like little girl guide badges on the things which say like wrapping division or communications or S1 support or whatever.
Well, this
ridiculous.
Is the perfect example of how long it's taken. When did this start? How much?
We started, I think it must be about 4.5 years ago now, I think, when I was actually at Aardman, supposedly just for 6 months secondment to develop a slate of films for them. And this one came to me from Pete, who's like my very long-term friend and collaborator, and we've worked together before. And he rang me up and I said, come on, Pete, I'm going to be at Aardman. Have you got any ideas? And he said, I think I might have had one of my best ideas ever. And he pitched the like 2-minute version to me. And because it was Pete, as I started working on it with him, I just totally fell in love with it, and it sort of became our joint baby. So we worked on the script for about, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years, and then it's been in production for about 2.5 years now.
I've heard about, with animation, that a lot of times the storyboard, like you guys will storyboard the whole thing, figure it out, doesn't work, go back and re-storyboard. Mm. How many times did you go through this to tweak it, to get it right?
We actually were very unusual because I don't come from an animation background. I come from live action, and I'm a very big script person. I believe in scripts. And so we didn't go the storyboard route. We had no story team for the first year. Pete and I wrote drafts of the script. We worked it and worked it on paper for a long time, and the fundamentals of it have never really changed. I mean, it always had the same basic structure. The middle of the movie, from the point at which you just left off, it becomes a crazy road trip with the old sleigh out in the modern world, not really suited and equipped for the modern world, and the North Pole. Wait, it's sort of like Christmas 24, the North Pole kind of waking up to the fact there's something going on out there, and the rest of the world wakes up to the fact that there's something out there because they don't have anti-radar device. They get picked up by air traffic control as the world thinks it's a UFO or whatever. So it's a kind of big adventure, and they get blown off course all around the world. They get to Africa and Mexico and before they finally kind of get to their destination. So that part of the movie was the most kind of malleable because it was basically, we said, you have that problem of like you can go anywhere in the world. In fact, they do go everywhere in the world, and they even go into space at one point. So you could, it's very, very difficult to select that down to the kind of number of sequences that you want because you could have the sleigh go anywhere and anything happen. But the beginning of it, the idea of how we would show it, showing the mission, something has gone wrong, the aftermath with the family, what the politics of that was, the old sleigh, and then the end part of the movie, when they finally get to it, that's always been absolutely the same, but that was from script. The fundamentals of that were the same. So I guess we went through several drafts of the script. Then we did go through a storyboard process, of course, and I guess we did about 3 passes on the reels in order to try and, you know, work some of that The stuff that was most affected by storyboards is action sequences, really, where, you know, what you write kind of changes as you discover visual jokes.
When it comes to Aardman projects, there's the nice split between the something like this and the stop motion animation. Yeah. Was this immediately something you knew that was going to be computer generated?
Yeah, because I think, you know, although Aardman obviously has historically been, in people's eyes, a stop frame studio, mostly I guess it's Nick's influence and all the other stuff that spun off from that, the company does do a different range of things, and it's what fits the story. This would never have worked in stop frame, because it's a high-tech world, and it has a million L's, and you want that scale. You want that feeling of something spectacular and high-tech, and also I wanted the world to feel like our real world. You know, my whole feeling about what I wanted the world to be was I didn't want it to have a very, very strong sort of skewing design choice that had a, you know, I wanted it to feel like the world as every kid knows it is, so that where the little girl lives is a very average housing estate, etc., and they go to gas stations and all things that kids would recognize, but put through the filter of how a child feels on Christmas night. You know, when you lie in bed on Christmas Eve and you think about the street outside your window and you know it's still the same road and there's still it's the same world, but somehow you feel it as a sort of heightened, sparkly, magical thing. So that was the idea of the look of it. To do something that had that much scope and scale, I mean, even the invasion sequence, that would be it. We'd have killed Aardman even trying to do that, let alone then having the sleigh fly. Things like flying as well are not really, you know, stop frame things to do. I think stop frames work best with contained worlds. You know, the pirate ship is fantastic. The pirates has actually got great scope and they're using CG to give themselves more scale. But at the heart of it is the pirates and the pirate ship, and that's a fabulous thing to do in stop frame, you know.
Oh, I was going to say, something that's great about the film is the adult jokes, the lead paint. There's a lot of stuff for adults in just the first, what you showed us. Does that continue throughout the entire film? And also, just talk about, you know, the adult jokes.
Well, I guess Grand Santa is the carrier of an awful lot of that. I mean, I never ever think of writing it for kids. That's not true. We wanted to be very respectful of what kids believe about Christmas. So the fact that we show elves delivering things, we also said, but some people, kids really want to feel that it's Santa in their room. So we also show that Santa does deliver some presents. You know, we tried to make sure that we weren't stepping on what kids want to believe about Christmas. So we did care about that in terms of writing for children. But other than that, you know, I'm totally with the kind of Pixar mantra of you have to write it for yourself. You have to try and make yourself laugh, because otherwise you're patronizing your audience, and children are unbelievably sophisticated. I mean, you watch The Simpsons with a 7-year-old. And they get all the, you know, they get the sophisticated jokes. And if they don't get everyone, they like the fact that there's something to reach for, you know, that they're trying to get as well. So we wrote it for ourselves, to make ourselves laugh, you know. And I guess particularly Grand Santa is in that kind of vein, because he's the sort of truthsayer, you know, he's the sort of the grandparent who actually says out loud what everyone else is thinking and doesn't care whether it's politically correct or not. I'm just basically my grandmother.
But there also seems to be some nice setups in the adult relationships that kids might not get, but that parents would get, that'd be really funny. And one of the things I was curious about is, you've got this great sort of setup between the current Santa and his son Steve. Mm. Steve obviously really wants to be Santa. Mm. And I'm just curious, I don't know if it gets revealed later on in the film, but is there sort of a backstory in your head about when Steve sort of like helped to make this trend? Because he's played in the first 20 minutes like Santa can't really do this on his own, but he must have at some point.
Yeah. So it's like the idea that our idea was that, you know, you live with this kind of traditional Christmas myth of Santa. And I think it is slightly confusing for children when they start trying to think their way into it. Like, I've heard about St. Nicholas. Is that the same Santa that's a lot? You know, once you start to go there, it all gets a bit kind of, you know, how do you hold it all together? So, and, you know, our idea was that, like, well, of course, like everything else, just because you haven't seen it, the Santa operation would have to have moved on in order to do that. And we want that to be a positive thing. That's not a negative thing. It's like, wow, look, they've kept up. They really can do 2 billion presents. They really could do. What would it actually take to do that? And part of that is, you know, the idea that Santa has changed over the years. Okay, so once it was St. Nicholas with, you know, a donkey, and now it's, you know, what would it be today? So that means that you're then into the whole idea of a family and succession and so on. Our idea about Steve, I think the thing, the thought of Santa is that he's a lovely, benign Santa. it's kind of the most wonderful job in the world. Why would you ever want to give it up? You know, a bit like if you're sort of president for 30 years and everyone loves you, you know, it's kind of hard to, and also that you just become Santa and he has that little moment of going, well, who would I be if I wasn't Santa? But he has these sons, and Steve is supposed to be like the architect. You know, it's a very kind of classic family business scenario. You know, he's the one with the ideas who's actually managed to keep them. And without him, how would they ever have kept up with the times? He's the architect of the thing. And Santa is supposed, we're trying to show him, is just incredibly busy and slightly exhausted. And therefore, he doesn't quite have enough time for his own children. And he hasn't quite paid enough attention to them. Not out of, you know, callousness. He just has, he's in a world where he's kind of a sort of father figure to 2 billion children. Well, what does that mean if you're actually Santa's own kid? So Steve is supposed to be that incredibly bright kind of overachiever who's never quite been noticed. His dad hasn't ever quite paid enough open attention and gone, well done, you did that. And that's all he really wants, is for his dad to go, well done. There is a moment later on in the film where Steve gets very sort of upset and his kind of, you know, inner kid comes out and he's stamping his foot at Santa and going, oh yes, that's right, you know, you don't care about the 2 billion things I did right tonight, just the one I got wrong, you know, sort of classic kid thing. And Santa looks at him bemused and goes, this is about that pool table, isn't it? And it kind of emerges as some story when Steve was 7 and, you know, and he said, you should have written to me. And he said, but you're my dad, you know, this sort of slightly kind of awkward thing of like, your dad is Santa. It's about being the child of an icon as well and of someone famous and who's incredibly successful. And it's a sort of problem for both Steve and Arthur. It's like, what would it be like if your dad was Santa? Kind of in love with him.
How do you decide who is going to play the voices?
I always thought of the Santa family as being like the British royal family, really. And so we kind of looked at the sort of British royal family of actors as a starting point. I mean, Jim Broadbent to me, you know, I think it's very hard casting Santa, and it's one of the reasons why I always thought when Pete told me this idea it should be animation and not live action, because I think as soon as you put a famous actor in the part of Santa, it distances you from it. And in a funny way, it's easier to believe it's real when you see it in animation and you're not actually seeing, you know, whoever it is who you've put in there as Santa. But in terms of voice and the feeling, I mean, Jim Broadbent to me just has such a benign, you know, if you were a kid and you woke up and it was Jim Broadbent, that would be fine. It was him in your room, you know, delivering the present. Imelda Staunton has that marvellous sort of, you know, self-contained royal family army wife thing. James McAvoy, I looked for Arthur's for a long time. In fact, we kind of stumbled across all, we were looking around all sorts of people who then kind of got fantastic careers, like Andrew Garfield, who's doing, you know, Spider-Man now, and Matt Smith, who then became Doctor Who. And we were looking at all these kind of young actors. And then somewhere along the line, I saw that film that James McAvoy did. Was it called The Last Station? When he played a much younger character. And I just thought, there's something about him. He's such a sort of live, wiry character. And when I heard his voice, I think he's one of the interesting people, because he's, as a performer, because he's very different, and who he is and what he looks like and his age and everything is very different from the character he's playing. And yet when I hear the voice, to me it belongs to Arthur and not to James. Whereas Jim Broadbent sort of is Santa, you know. And Grand Santa, my original thought was to look, I kind of went after my comedy heroes who are now in their, you know, Grand Santa years, as it were, thinking that I would cast one of them. But I kept looking for that kind of roguish sort of spirit, you know, and Bill Nye just has that in spades. He's just naughty in a fun way. And you kind of, he's somebody that you want to spend a movie with, and you would like, you want him to be your wicked granddad. And the idea is that, you know, Grand Santa, he's this tiny, frail old man, but he's got this massive sort of energy and spirit to him, and Bill does that fabulously, I think.
There's something really neat about seeing this that sort of goes outside the normal screenplay format. There's not really a villain, it's more from the situation. Mm. There doesn't seem to be like a romantic interest that he's trying to impress with this. Can you talk about writing that and the challenges of...
Oh no, we forgot. There's a little romantic interest in that later on you have Santa and Mrs. Santa sort of the blooming when they suddenly realise that, you know, Santa realises it's okay to retire because he's got Mrs. Santa, so we get a near kiss, if that's any use. And in the villain, I remember Pete once in the first year when we were writing, he rang me up and he went, look, I think we need a villain. What if we have this really evil elf called, I can't remember what his name was, General Antler, that was it. And he's got this whole idea about they're going to slaughter, he wants to make burgers out of the reindeer, and we see like that, and he sent me something and it was like the Killing Fields, you know, with like drip trays catching the blood. And I was like, Pete, it's a Christmas movie? I don't think so. But also, I felt when we were talking about it, I mean, I think whether you're writing for kids or anything, you have to write something that feels true to you. And the thing in the movie to me, which is the most true thing, is, you know, that it isn't really evil that's wrong with the world today. It's slightly kind of, it's the evil of not getting it. You know, Steve is sort of the baddie because he just doesn't quite get it. You know, he does Christmas, he's running all these things, but it's sort of for the wrong reasons. And like late on in the movie, he sort of storms in after a particularly disastrous moment. He says, okay, so I'm not good with children. Does that make me a bad Santa? And there's this sort of little moment, you know. And it's the fact of, you know, what's wrong with the world is that people have kind of, it's not that there are terrible evil things happening. It's just the slight kind of crapness of things not happening for good reasons is sort of the worst thing that happens around us. And that's really what Steve kind of embodies. He does get it in the end, though, you'll be glad to know.
You guys are releasing this in 3D. How early on did you guys know you were going to go 3D? And also, can you talk about, you know, any challenges you've had to overcome?
Or is it a conversion, or is it? Did you guys shoot it in 3D?
It's a conversion, but it happened sort of simultaneously, so there was some kind of interaction between the two. But we knew right from the very beginning that it was going to be in 3D. It's really, really hard choices. I mean, I'm not a 3D expert, and I've learned a huge amount about what works and what doesn't, and I think it's a really hard thing because often what you shoot for 2D is the opposite of the choices you would make for 3D. Like, for example, I wanted that invasion sequence. I always wanted to do a sort of Paul Greengrass handheld camera thing, which is quite hard in animation anyway, with very fast cuts and, you know, moving cameras and so on. That doesn't lend itself to 3D, so there's an immediate challenge. You've got two different aesthetics, but it does kind of work for what kids think is cool in action. Having said that, I think there's a huge amount in the movie that is spectacular in 3D. One of the choices we made, and it's come out of really the choices we made about the world rather than saying, let's do it for 3D. You know, we don't have anyone poke you in the eye, for example. But I think the things that make it a gorgeous experience in 3D, one is the amount of detailing and how tactile and rich the world is. So if you see the sleigh barn sequence in 3D, it's fantastic because you feel you're walking in this amazingly gorgeous, detailed world. And also Arthur's office is the same. It's full of little props and details that have a kind of physicality in 3D, which is brilliant. The other choice I made early on was when they go out on the sleigh, I wanted it to be like a road movie. So rather than shoot it with big sweeping CG cameras, we attached the cameras to the sleigh, as it were. We thought of them as mounts on a car and shot it like that. And that's actually makes a lot of the action sequences in the sleigh, I think, fantastic for 3D because visually you're anchored by the sleigh and it feels like being in a car of a roller coaster. So you're in it with them and the world is going by you in this kind of like, wah! You know, you're on the ride basically because you're inside the sleigh. The other thing which is fabulous in 3D is Mission Control because it's like the biggest set you've ever seen and it has fantastic lines of perspective from the camera right to the distance and then in the background big 2D screens, which is like the perfect 3D design. You know, it has fantastic scale. So I think you know, there were some things where we had to make the decision about which is the 3D, which is the 2D. Like, as I say, the action sequence at the beginning, we decided to make it more with 2D in mind, and then 3D follows. You know, they scale down their effects. But a lot of it, the 3D pictures have opened up the images in a brilliant way.
How long did it take to shoot?
The pre-production, once we were greenlit on the basis of a script entirely, not of storyboards. So from then, we had about a year and a half in Bristol. So we managed to do the whole creative kind of setup of it here, which was brilliant because we had a lot of time and space and secrecy to kind of work it out. And we did design and storyboarding in Bristol for about a year and a half. And then we then moved to Imageworks in LA and did about a year and a half in shot production, animation and shots. It's crazy animation, it's ridiculous. There were times I just wanted to run into the animation team and just go, do you know, you can get actors, and they walk on their own. What?
when you're co-directing, is there something that you sort of take on as like, I'm going to really be in charge of this, or is it back and forth?
I basically directed it. I had a co-director for a period of time because I was pregnant and had a baby. But in fact, the last 2 years I did on my own.
Oh, okay.
And I think, you know, it was fantastic to have some support early on in the process, especially as I was off on maternity leave, etc. But I think, you know, it had sort of been you know, mine and Pete's kind of project at the very beginning, and it, in some ways it's a nightmare trying to do it on your own because it's such a giant amount of work and there are so many people to interact with. But it's also in other ways easier because you kind of carry the idea of it and you can make it coherent, you know, and you don't have that, you know, difficulty. I mean, I think my relationship with Pete really is the strongest one in that we know each other so well. We've known each other for 20 years. So although we argue the toss about everything, it's from the point of view of fundamentally, basically agreeing about everything. So that, you know, you're arguing about the best way of doing it or the best detail. And that's a very, you can't turn that relationship on, you know. That comes from knowing somebody and working with them for years and years and years. So Pete's been a good touchstone for me all the way through. I couldn't really recreate that with another director. It's a hard thing. You start just getting different points of view. So, in fact, once we went out to America, I ran with the thing myself.
Aardman has done other films. Are there any Easter eggs in this? Little nods to other things?
Yes, in Gwen's bedroom, she has a Shaun the Sheep backpack. And she has a Chop Socky Chooks poster as well, I think. And she has a little Shaun the Sheep. There's a Shaun the Sheep squeaky toy that gets trodden on. And there's one in the bit that you saw, a very tiny homage to The Wrong Trousers when the elf is laying the track for the little, you know, when she's giving the railway set to the kid, the last present that gets delivered when you see them sitting on the thing. That's the Wrong Trousers moment.
It seems like a film that embraces the international side of Christmas. Mm. Was there anything you came across in, like, I mean, in America, our sort of like perfect Christmas is the British Christmas, probably because of like Charles Dickens and Christmas Carol.
Snow, yeah.
But are there places that you came across where there's just Christmas traditions that are very strange?
That's really quite hard, actually. We did research Christmas traditions, and, you know, you'll suddenly be in front of, you know, an exhibitor from some country who goes, but we celebrate Christmas on the 5th of December. And you're like, shh, don't tell everyone that, you know. We don't get presents on that night, you know. So to some extent, we've had to kind of put a slightly colonial view, which is, it's 25th of December, Santa comes the night before, that's how it goes. It was the same issue we had early on. I think the worst kind of most heated row that Pete and I had was about 3 or 4 days early on in the story development when we discussed the idea of featuring time zones, because we suddenly went, wait a minute, you know, if it starts like, if they're actually chasing night, you know, Santa could have like however many hours it is, not just 10 hours to deliver it, but whatever. And suddenly that seemed fantastic, that the old sleigh would be going around, there'd be all this. And then we realized that that is such a kind of bag of worms. And also for a Christmas movie that you've got the countdown, they've got to get this present there before dawn, because obviously in our world, no child wakes up before the sun comes on Christmas night. As we all know, that's true. So their kind of deadline is they have to get this present in the last 2 hours before the sun comes up. So if you were flying in and out of time zones and suddenly landing in Africa and the sun's up, I think it would just completely ruin your jeopardy. So we had to go, come on, for kids, Christmas night is night. They don't start thinking about the fact that in Australia, some child's already awake. You know, you've got to preserve the magic of that sort of idea, haven't you?
You've got so much going on. Do you ever, and maybe there's something later on, where parents are trying to put down presents like they are?
We didn't particularly feature that. We had it there at the beginning that there are already other presents under the tree, mm-hmm. and there's obviously the bit of like parents being awake. But in the rest of the movie, they go to so many different crazy places. I mean, they actually end up in Africa, you know, singing Silent Night to the lions to try and get out of trouble. So it's not necessarily always in other... It doesn't necessarily, after that first bit, it's not particularly about different houses. There's one other house that gets visited, but, you know, they're on this kind of much more big sort of world road trip, and it becomes about the fact, you know, that I think one of the central things in the movie, it's not like the old ways are good and the new ways are bad. We weren't trying to say the old sleigh and the reindeer, even though it's gorgeous and beautiful, that's the answer, because you do kind of love it and it is gorgeous, but you also see that it's impractical. How could that deliver all of those presents? And so it's not like which is good and which is bad. It's the point is why you do it, not how you do it, you know. And the very, very end of the movie has Arthur actually riding the tiny child's bicycle the last mile and a half, because he's like hurt his legs, so he's like this big gangly guy riding the bicycle while Brani the elf, who's the stowaway, is trying to wrap it at the same time. And, you know, that was the point, was in the end all the stuff goes away, the S1, the old sleigh, whatever, it doesn't matter how you get there, it doesn't even matter if you ride the bike there itself, the point is the desire, that caring about the kid at the other end is the point of the movie.
DVD, home video is now such a huge part of everything. Did you guys do anything special, or are you doing anything special for the home video?
We will do, but it's going to be for next Christmas.
Oh, they're going to hold it?
Yeah. Because, I mean, it'll be on release, you know, up until, and so it'll happen next year, and we'll add some extras to it then.
Oh, would that give you a lot more time if you wanted to do, say, like, a small little short film?
Exactly, yeah. I hope we will. There's no way we could have got it together for this Christmas as well. It's been such a tricky deadline because, you know, delivering 2 weeks late on the movie means next Christmas release, and so it's been such an absolute wall that we're hitting.
When is your due date? When you had to...
We have to deliver by the end of next week. We actually deliver the film.
Are we keeping you from anything?
The sound mix.
Well, I was going to say just real quick. A lot of movies obviously get deleted scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you have any sequences that you like pulled out really like close to now and you know?
That's a good question. There is something. What was it? I was thinking. No, there's very. I mean, in animation, it's so expensive. That you don't really have deleted scenes unless you really have a big problem. I mean, that's the whole point of the storyboarding, etc., is you see that early on and you end up having to commit. There were versions. There are little extra bits and pieces here and there that we've trimmed, but not a huge amount. But there are extra scenes and deleted scenes in storyboards and different ideas that we had that are quite different that we might include, because that shows, you know, the different choices that you made early on.
You know, the character design, did you make a conscious effort to move away from, say, like, Wallace and Gromit and Flushed Away?
My aspiration for the character design was, I didn't want to go the Flushed Away route of trying to copy the stop frame look. That was my choice. I think, you know, Nick's character design, you know, he's one of the best character designers in the world. People don't think of him like that, but I think he is. I think it's one of the things that makes his movie spectacular is his characters are fantastic. But to me, they totally belong to Nick and they belong to stop frame. So what I wanted for these characters was I wanted them... in the end, to feel like they only could have come from Aardman, that they belonged to the family of characters of Aardman. And I think they do. I don't think they look like, you know, CG human characters from other studios, but not by using that aesthetic. So to me, the things that make them part of the Aardman family is we didn't try and make any of them cute, particularly. They weren't trying to look appealing. They are themselves. They have a slightly rough and ready kind of thing about them. Like, for instance, Grand Santa was... There was an early material that Aardman did years ago, looking at Arthur now. Was it War Stories? It wasn't War Stories. It was another one of Pete Lord's very early things. There was an old man, anyway. And it had that fantastic, slightly kind of crumpled old man look from this plasticine. And that was one of the inspirations for Grand Santa. Our characters are quite asymmetrical. You know, they are... I really tried to make them themselves. Like, we started off by just drawing, you know, how did we feel them as characters, and then develop them into a sort of shape language. And in the end, when I look at them, I do feel they look like Aardman characters. You know, they do, Grand Santa especially, you know, they have a sort of imperfection about them, I suppose.
Yeah.
And they feel sort of British and quirky.
They're slightly odd. Look,
yeah, they're slightly odd, yeah. In a kind of British way, yeah, you know, they're not airbrushed, basically.
Yeah.
They're not airbrushed. And Arthur, you know, I wanted Arthur to be really appealing, but really not cute. And I don't think he is, really. If you look at him facially, he's quite odd-looking. But I had the idea of giving him very soft hair that would make you want to sort of pat him.
Oh.
And also the slippers, when we had the idea of giving him kind of a terrible Christmas sweater and those slippers. And then I thought, well, you make those slippers really soft and furry and you give him soft. There's something about him that's kind of like... bless, you know, even though he's obviously a mess and wears terrible sort of sweatpants with, you know, baggy knees and stuff like that.
Okay, one more question maybe.
There's something about Christmas movies that's great, sort of as you mentioned with the DVD, Next Christmas, that they become timeless and they become something that people go back to each year. Was there anything, because you're dealing with a very present day Christmas, anything that like was a specific technology that...
That's really hard. The technology thing is really hard because it moves on so fast. You know, we have the HoHo 3000. We also have the HoPad, which came in later in the middle of our design when the iPad came out. We were like, well, Steve ought to have one of those. But you're very aware that that stuff changes and that that's the stuff potentially which can date you. So all you can do is try and kind of place your graphics and your things in a slightly kind of timeless place and hope that you don't look incredibly dated in 10 years' time. It's a tough one. It's really tough doing technology. And also, it's kind of hard doing... technology and animation. You know, the last time I saw something like that was in WALL-E, you know, and they chose for a very simplified look in their graphics and so on. And we chose to go a little further and make them a little more kind of somewhere between Minority Report and, you know, and kind of Chris. So, and it was a kind of complicated choice because we actually had even cooler graphics at one point, but I realised when I was watching that whole Waker sequence that you needed the kid elements in it to make it funny. It's like the cool offset by the ridiculous picture of a cow and a milkmaid. You know, that was what kind of made it play, because they're taking so seriously kind of slightly lightweight, trivial things. But yeah, the technology is the hardest thing of all, because who knows, you know, in 5 years' time, there may be no computer terminals. We all just have glass screens or something, and then that will date us. But I hope not, because as you say, you know, one of the aspirations for a Christmas film is that it's something that lasts, that people will, you know, love beyond 1 year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've got lamps in the bar area.